welcome everybody. I hope my voice is loud enough, and I hope my English will be fine as well. And if not, please do interrupt, and then I will try to explain myself. This is the topic we are going to discuss, and this is who we are. And first, I really would like to, Kevin, give you the floor to tell who you are exactly.
Well, it's a bit difficult. Public historian. Started studying history when it was back in 2015, I think, or even 14. And I tried to find ways into queer history within the normal curriculum at the University of Amsterdam. And that was really difficult. So when I found ways to do that, I tried to apply it as well to a museum, for example. So I started researching the Amsterdam Museum collection of LGBTQ objects, which was my bachelor thesis. And Riemer was the lead for me to start discussing that. And then we had Europride in 2016. I started studying a master's in public history, and my internship became with the Amsterdam Museum as part of the curatorial team, and actually brought queer a bit in the museum, but also launched a lot of interesting new projects, and we are going to work on these topics and discuss them, but we also have a question in the end on how we can progress further.
Yes, so we're going very briefly towards it. My name is Mirjam Sneeuwloper. I'm an educator, curator, public programming. And I always find it very important when we are on talking about these issues to tell you my own perspective as well, and why it's so important that Kevin was able to come along with us. I work in the museum on the collection on the topic of queering, though my perspective is that I'm a white woman, you can see that. I'm a cisgender heterosexual woman as well. And so I've got a different perspective than the topic I'm working on. And that's very interesting, because who is allowed to say something, or who is allowed to be on the table, to sit on the table and to make this discussion? One of the things I've learned in the last couple of years, and I was at the last conference in London as well, and I was then at a different point of my thinking. One of the topics I learned was that making space within your own museum or your own institution is really important, though as well I think it's important to still have the perspective of all of us. So I think I am able to say something about the topic, but I'm really not able to do that on my own. So that's why we are. So this is our official titles. The other titles we've got is actually that Kevin is an LGBTQI plus activist, which means he does a lot of voluntary jobs, like all of you, of course. And I do think, actually, I'm a museum activist as well, though that's not the only thing, because I'm also the toilet lady, really. Within the Amsterdam Museum, and because we had such a good connection with all of the trans communities within the city of Amsterdam, we make a program together, an exhibition. The thing was as well, and you all know, because you know I'm preaching for our own choir, I think it's an expression in English, is that we didn't have any like gender neutral or all neutral or for everybody toilet. We had men toilets and women's toilets. And it's really strange. That was something we've just changed, and that was really easy to do, because it was we could do it because we had like an exhibition for about 6 months. So management was all right. We were only going to try it out for 6 months. We still got them though, so that's very important. When that happened, and up till now, I'm with a lot of journalists looking at our toilets. I'm not joking. I'm going into it. And then they say, is it the same toilet? Yes, it's the same. Oh, it's a special toilet? No, it's a toilet. And it's still in the newspapers up till now, since so long. And because we've heard a lot about people that I've heard a lot of talks that we're doing really well and very brilliant. And as well, I've heard a lot of talks that it's not going as fast as we would like, or, you know, something is holding back. And is a museum, is that a place to make your point? I do believe there is a sort of soft power within cultural institutions, which you should not overlook. or we should not overlook, but as well, we have to work together to make that happen. And one of the things is, as simple as it is, toilets is not about toilets. Toilets is about making space. Toilets is about who's allowed to be where. Toilets is about where you can, how you can feel free in a surrounding. And as well, we had a lot of discussions, because before that, all the men working within our museum said, oh, we really don't want to go to the women's toilets because they're filthy. And all the women actually said the same, we don't want to go into the men's toilet because it's filthy. We really have to think through it, because I was like, oh, really? But then we've got a different problem. We've got a problem of hygiene. And I think everybody is entitled to have a clean toilet, no matter what, who you are or who you identify yourself. So that's a really different subject. And with lots of the topics around queering, we have to go a level deeper all the time when somebody is saying, right, I don't think it should be like that. Then we think, oh, wait, what's really the problem? What is really the problem? And do we need to change our role, or do we need to change our rules? So we're going to do a few slides about how wonderful we are. So this is the Amsterdam Museum. It's a city museum. We do have a few other locations. Because of time, I will leave this out. This is who we are. And you said something which was really interesting.
But these are official photos from the Amsterdam Museum, and in publication details, etc., and in press. But it starts already here. And this is how I start my museum tours as well. I start with a simple painting from 16th, 17th century, and I ask people, what do we see here? I see a man, I see a woman, and I see children. And that's where it starts in our institutions, because what we see is heteronormativity portrayed over and over and over again, and we enforce it on people. But I also think about the children and our next generations. What do they see when they enter a museum? Do they see deviant sexualities normalized, or do they see heteronormativity enforced again? And here we see that again in official pictures from the Amsterdam Museum. We don't see gay people, we don't see lesbian women, we don't see trans people. No, we see heteronormativity enforced upon us again.
So most of the time, our perspective as an institution, and even though we do have people connected towards LGBT communities working there, it's still very white, Western, cisgender, heteronormative, automatically. That's how we look at it. We did have an exhibition, just very shortly, at the end of 1980s, beginning of 1990, it was called Goed Verkeerd, which is good to be on the wrong side, which actually...
Good wrong, yes, basically.
Yes, and it's translated in English, Two of a Kind, so it was already quite a few decades ago an exhibition about LGBTQI, which was not called like that at that time. And then in 2015, we started a little bit early, we had an exhibition called Transmission. And Transmission was an exhibition which was made together with the trans communities of the Amsterdam. First of all, we were connected with all the people within the trans communities who are very looking the same as our regular audience. So they were all like older and... so older, and they were used, highly educated. There were no younger, edgy, queer people at that time involved, though we had it like running for a couple of months, and then afterwards more stories came in. 5 minutes, we're going quickly. I won't explain to you what that wonderful object is on the side. We do have Pride in the museum, and we did it for a couple of years already. And we do have some spin-offs. So one of the spin-offs is the
Amsterdam Rainbow Dress. Do a lot of people know what the Amsterdam Rainbow Dress is or not?
No.
It's
no.
A dress made from all the flags of countries in which homosexuality or brother is still criminalized. Mm-hmm. And every time it is in the collection of the Amsterdam Museum. There's also an Amsterdam Rainbow Dress Foundation. And the dress is traveling the world. So it's a museum object that is not stored within the collection center. No, it's a special requisite, if I'm correct, as they call it, in which it's allowed to travel the world and be worn by people. And even photographs were taken in the Rijksmuseum, which is the National Museum of the Netherlands, which is unique because photographs are not allowed even in the museum, and especially not in the room they did that. This was not in that museum.
It's the Europe Parliament.
Good.
Good as
well. And every time that a country decriminalizes homosexuality, I say homosexuality now, but I mean rather the dress is replaced by a rainbow flag. And of course, the purpose eventually to have a full dress, only rainbow flags.
But what's been, I think, very interesting, and that's why you can use the power of a cultural institution, it's that because it is a museum object, it's something more than only an activist job. Though, actually, this is one of the objects, I think it's a very, like, activist object we are working with. So that's interesting. I don't know if everybody who's working in our museum is aware of that. We have LGBTQI perspective tours. You will see Kevin here as well. So you see him two times. During the Pride, we had lots of activities, but as well queer history talks. And the queer history talks were something where we could go from a temporarily programming towards a more permanent programming of queer histories at the Amsterdam Museum. And that's because when we have issue dates, they are very important for me as a personnel from the museum to have this issue dates and to have this calendar, so I can tell the management that it's important. Though if you're only doing the Pride after a couple of years, it's a bit shallow. I mean, you know, you can't do just Pride and have this all queer activities or going on as perspective tours and then all the rest of the year, well, we're not really that interested. So during those Pride weeks, we are trying out new ways, new activities we can do longer. So we can have 2 minutes, my God. but not longer this. We have an editorial board for the programming. We had a couple of queer history talks this year. We only started this year. This is about women music in the 70s in Amsterdam and the 80s. So these are the ladies then, and they're now in their 60s, almost in their 70s, and they're having their queer history talks here, telling about recent stories. They're wonderful. I fell in love with them. They're really, really great. We have bicultural programming during the queer history talks about visibility and how that is quite difficult to see that in Amsterdam at the 80s, but actually still now. And we had something trans men, so female to male, and they're having their own talk as well, which was a very small self-help group. It's a very small self-help group. They started in their own house in Amsterdam, and they came towards, because we had this editorial board, it was very important that I had this editorial board together, because they said, well, this is quite an interesting subject, and I was this very small subject. But it was not a very small subject. There were 50 people at our activity, because the activity came from the community itself. It would be very easy for me to have queer history talks every month and to phone somebody, say, can you give me, can you come along and tell something? But that's not the way it works. And we have to round off. You can't read this unless you're Dutch or you study Dutch. People are actually advising us as well about which collection, why we should have collection in our museum or not. And this is all that glitter is not gold. I really want to end with this.
It's a quote by Shakespeare, so you forgot to mention that. But what we encounter now, and that's also our question to you actually, is how can we progress further? Because at the same time, I am in that editorial committee, and I see that it's very difficult to keep on doing those queer history talks, because we have to find a subject, but I am a volunteer, so I work 4 days a week and actually don't have enough time to really invest in sustainable programming. But how can that symbiote between the Amsterdam Museum and the community take the next step? How can we take a big leap towards sustainable inclusion?
Yes.
How can we do that? And that's hopefully something you can think about and we can maybe come back to in the panel.
Yes, because we think this is... we think this is important. We took a lot of baby steps and we're now noticing that the community, especially the community in Amsterdam or in the Netherlands perhaps, and the younger generations, they want to go further and they want to have takeovers. And I think they should do that, but it's as well, we're still searching how we should do it. So even though we had a lot of good examples, we're not there yet. So please help us at the end. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry to be the talk master, but I think that you have some very good questions that we can continue with after the four presentations. And now we go further with the presentation from Herbert, who is working with the memory of with the London Metropolitan Archive.
That's right. Just start the timer so I don't overrun, because I will otherwise. I rather like the sound of my own voice.
Okay.
So, so that's not working, so we'll just do it. Just wait me. Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name's Tom Ferber, and I'm from London Metropolitan Archives. London Metropolitan Archives is a second largest archive in the United Kingdom. We are a local authority archive. We are the archive for the Greater London, for the Greater London area. What I'd like to do in the sort of the 10-15 minutes that I have this afternoon is to discuss some of our LGBTQ plus programming and three sort of challenges or questions or three ways I think about the LGBTQ plus programming based on sort of my reflections of the work that we do. So we can think of this work, I like to think of this work in sort of three areas, three challenges that it poses to us. How do we evidence other sides of the past? How do we fulfil our professional and personal responsibilities to our depositors? And how do we adapt to changing institutional and cultural circumstances? So I'd like to present these challenges to you. I'd very much like to hear your opinions on them. I think we'll wait for the sort of the discussion to do that. Very much like to hear your input. I'd like to present the challenges and then present some of the ways that we've sought to meet these challenges. So the first challenge, and this is very common, we've seen this as really a theme throughout all throughout most, if not all, the presentations in this conference so far, is how do we evidence other sides of the past? I dare say each institution or each place has a slight nuance to this problem, but the problem is, broadly speaking, I think the same across countries and across institutional settings. In the context of London Metropolitan Archives, we are a state archive, we are a local authority archive. That means we have church records, court records, criminal justice records, medical records, and these provide lots of stories about LGBTQ plus people, but not really stories by LGBTQ plus people. We can think of the stories that they're presenting are in terms of the criminalisation, the medicalisation, and the sort of the moralisation, the demonisation of LGBT plus people. And that's quite a problem for us, because as a state archive, we have to think about what collections come into us more naturally, sort of a matter of course, and what things we have to kind of go out and look for. So things like courts, things like hospitals, businesses and churches, to perhaps a lesser extent, they have to keep records, and to a certain extent they have to, by law, be kept somewhere, and often that means us. But these organisations have not historically been unfriendly, critical, downright damning of LGBT plus people. So those records are kept easily, and we have those. That's very much one side of the story. How do we evidence the lives of LGBT plus people through their own voices, their own experiences, and in their own voice? That's one challenge that we have. And this is some of the ways that we've sought to meet that challenge. You've excused some of the jargon here, but this is a challenge to what we would think of as our sort of professional practice. So as a large archive, we have to the standard ways that we work, I'm not an archivist myself, but we have sort of professionals who are used to being trained to work in a certain way, they're used to working a certain way, they're used to working in sort of a certain sort of bureaucratic environment. That's the only way a large archive can really work. But we have to think, how does that bureaucracy, how do those practices, how do they limit what we can collect, and how do we have to adapt and change that practice to make sure we are evidencing those other sides of the past? So these are some of the things that we've done. I think I might just highlight a couple of things. The first is a collection of ephemera
Ephemera is just it's things like flyers, tickets, posters, those sorts of things. Traditionally, we've not really kept them in an archive. If one person comes in with a flyer, it doesn't really fit our catalogue. It doesn't really give a whole picture. We're more used to taking a whole organisation's record. So one thing on itself doesn't quite work. And maybe, to be honest, one thing by itself isn't that much of a record. But when you start to have tens, scores, hundreds, one day hopefully even thousands of these things, suddenly that's a story. So how do we change our collections to collect those things? So without getting too much into the technical details of archive cataloguing, we've just changed the way we catalogue slightly so we can collect based on an open collection of ephemera rather than simply collecting from an individual. We've also sort of broken our traditional collection policy of taking digital-only copies. So some archives do this differently, but it's been very much the policy of London Metropolitan Archives to only collect the real thing. We might have a digital surrogate, but we collect the real thing unless there's only a digital copy. But we collect the real thing, that's what we're there for. But actually, there's a challenge here, because if we're collecting ephemera, that can be very special to people. Lots of this ephemera lives under people's beds and shoeboxes. It's kind of memories of youth or happy times or new times. It's a bit of an ask to say, can we come, you know, that thing that's very special to you? It's a really good historical record. Can we have that and not give it back, please? It's a bit of a tricky situation. So we've digitised them and let people very graciously, we've let them keep the original. I'm being slightly flippant, but you can see what I'm getting at there. And the final thing that we've done is we've proactively collected all histories. There's a big old debate that we probably don't have time to go into, which we certainly don't have time to go into now, about archive versus oral history, memory versus record. It's a big topic which we don't need to enter into. But suffice to say, as an archive, traditionally we valued the paper sources over the oral history sources, archive over memory. But as some of you may have heard in Jan's introduction right at the start of the conference, when we're dealing with LGBTQ records, there's a different imperative there. So when I'm wearing another hat, I talk to all the school children, and I talk about archives as evidence of the past. Actually, there's in terms of LGBTQ records, the evidence has another and slightly more sinister meaning. As we've heard, certainly in the UK context, and of course other legal contexts as well, homosexuality was illegal. To keep evidence of history is to keep evidence to be kept in a court of law. So obviously we have to find non-paper ways to record things, and for us that's around proactive collection of oral histories. So we've gone to all this effort to collect new and different types of records. But that gives us a new sort of professional and personal responsibility to our depositors. If we're working with community groups, we need to both fulfil our promises to them. If we say, if you give us a collection, if you say you trust us with your things, we're going to do something with them, we need to do those things. But also we need to manage people's expectations as well. We're a big archive, but still there are constraints on our time and our resources. So we have to be sort of find that balance between the two things. That's one of our challenges, fulfilling our professional and personal responsibilities to our depositors. And that encompasses a wide range of things that we need to do or not do. But let me just highlight a couple for you. I think that the first and possibly most important is carefully guiding people through the depositing process and providing the different options for retaining ownership. Again, without sort of getting into the weeds technically, when you deposit to an archive, you can sort of give the collection to an archive, so the archive itself takes ownership of it. Or effectively, we can look after the collection for you. It can be properly catalogued, stored, kept in a climate-controlled environment, but it remains your collection. And for some people, that's very important. We are a state archive. We're owned and funded by the City of London Corporation. I don't expect you to understand the nuances of sort of English, sort of British politics, but the City of London Corporation is pretty conservative. To put it colloquially, we're the man. We are asking people to give their records to something that has probably been very much part of the established over the years. So some people, quite rightly, would prefer not to do that, and that is fine. And so they can retain ownership, or we can accept, and indeed we do accept, that some people will never want to deposit in the state archive. But we can still provide advice on how to care, how to look after, how to maintain, how to do outreach and events based on it with that acceptance, so that the collection is still being celebrated and used and stored, even if it doesn't have to come to us. And then there's things. And then the last one I think is really, really important as well. We need to not have what you might call a transactional relationship. And by that I mean it shouldn't be, we're not just working with private We're not just working with groups because we want their stuff, to put it colloquially. And also we need to realise that it's potentially a very different relationship with an individual or a small organisation that have kept records for very sort of strong personal, political, kind of emotional reasons. They have a different relationship to that catalogue than, say, a business or a hospital or a branch of local government, where they might be far more on the, don't want to worry about this, you guys, you nerds, you know how to put things in boxes, you look after them. That's a very different thing to kind of a labour of love and something that's quite important. So we need to sort of manage that relationship. We just owe them something a bit more and accept that it is a more personal relationship, and that's what it needs to be. And I almost feel a bit weird putting it on a slide, because it's that thing of if you're making a point of being nice, does that make you less nice? Do you see what I mean? It puts a sort of a weird cart before the horse sort of a situation. But I think you know what I'm getting at. But when we work in kind of time-crunched environments, when we feel a lot of pressure to clear the inbox, do this, do that, get on the phone, do all these things, it's easy to forget that actually one of the most important parts of your job is having a good relationship with your depositors in an unhurried, enjoyable way, and actually kind of enjoying what you do and enjoying their company, effectively. And then finally, we need to adapt to changing institutional and cultural circumstances. So this can both be financial. We're a relatively well-funded archive, but still public policy being what it is in the United Kingdom as well, the coffers are closing. We live in austerity. There's other terrible looming things on the horizon when it comes to the public purse in the United Kingdom. So how do we make the most of the resources that we have? Changes in staff. Sadly, when staff grow, they often don't seem to be replaced. Those sorts of things. Expertise goes. How do we keep things going? And also, in this kind of shrinking pool, there's a. It's perhaps not the problem that you might think. Certainly, in the South East London United Kingdom context recently, actually, sort of queer history, LGBTQ history is quite a popular thing to do. It's quite popular with the funders. So what that means is you're competing for grant funding, and the collections, and it's a bit jargony, collections can be sort of commodified. That is, it's something we want to keep because it gives a certain amount of cultural cachet. It's something that we want to keep because it gives access to grant funding. And sort of going back to the idea of having a good relationship with our depositors, how do we make sure that we're doing this because it's for the organisation, for the collection, and not because it helps us sort of tick our institutional boxes. And some ways that we've approached this, much like the previous presenters were saying, it's how do we not sit on rest on our laurels? How do we keep going? How do we try and do new things? As Walden and his wife does something for Pride Month. I noticed on my phone now, my Barclays bank account app's gone a nice rainbow colour. So it's as things change, we need to sort of stay ahead of the game, ask those deeper questions, like you said. The way we do that, our LGBTQ+ events and activities are part of our main programmes. There's a couple of examples. We've got a few brochures upstairs. Our schools workshops, our workshops are just part of what we do. We've also created a new sort of stakeholders group. We call it the Speak Out History Lab, and with the emphasis on the lab, of experimenting. We've been lucky enough to have the kind of the cultural institutional support LMA for the best part of 20 years now to be able to do things differently. How do we keep on doing things differently? How do we make it known that LMA is a place where we can do different types of events? We can offer our space. Venue space in London is at a premium. We're lucky enough for now to be able to offer rooms effectively for free or in kind. How do we bring new people in, use those kind of assets that we have just to try out new things, to build those relationships and keep on bringing new people in? Because ultimately, again, like the previous presenters were saying, we can run out of ideas. We can have so many ideas. You need to sort of refresh the soil. You need to replenish the well. And the way you do that is just by bringing new people in the whole time. So those are the sort of some of the things that I think about when I'm working with LGBT collections at LMA. How do we evidence other sides of the past? How do we fulfil our professional and personal responsibilities to our depositors? And how do we adapt to changing institutional cultural circumstances? I hope I'm presenting you with questions for thought and reflection rather than answers. Those are some of the ways that we've approached those challenges and those questions. And I'd be all ears for your responses and your thoughts in the Q&A at the end. Thank you very much. Thank you.
next up is Peter Hansi and Sandor.
Sandor, no.
Yeah, but I'm just saying you in together, but and you are with Hatter.
Archive
and Library Society. But you start.
Hello everybody, my name is Sandor Nagy, and I'm a founder and the director of program coordinator of the Hatter Archives. The Hatter Archive is one part of the Hatter Society, which is the oldest existing LGBT organization in Hungary. It was founded in 1995. And there are lots of programs to organize lots of services for the LGBT community, and we are the society took part in any other projects and organizes special events. I don't want to speak about it because if you need some details, you can see on the website. One of the program of the society is archives. Which is, as we know, the oldest LGBT archives in the Eastern region, East European region. We are working in the Hatter office, and last year the society moved to another flat where the archive has an own room, which is a very developing for us. In the library we have books in fiction and non-fiction system, and of course mainly Hungarian, but not just Hungarian languages. Oldest book is more than 100 years old, and of course we are trying to collect all of the main LGBT books as well. We have lots of non-LGBT periodicals which has LGBT themed, and of course the main LGBT periodicals like Mások, Homeros, Labris, we are collecting, and nowadays new periodicals also. Of course, we had some international LGBT magazines too. For example, the one archive, which collection we have from one archive as a gift. In media archive, we are collecting movies, documentaries, and radio and television programs. Of course, we have a big picture collections, mainly the main events and main persons of the LGBT movement in Hungary. For example, the gay prides. This big picture in the first gay pride was in 1997, and there are some pics about. The pride marches and some protesters. In press collection we had lots of newspaper articles in original and in net version of course and any other, we are collecting any other materials like documents, letters and catalogs and posters, focusing on of course the LGBT festivals and LGBT associations. And there are lots of short publications, leaflets, and HIV/AIDS prevention materials, and any other gadgets, T-shirts, bags. And we are working on a database and catalog system, which is working, but it's not available in online, just from our office. We are collecting here all of the books and films and essays we know about. And it's a catalog too, because it shows us what kind of materials we have in physically in the archive. The source of the funding is mostly free books from publishers and donations, or we are buying on our own, and we have not too much money to buy books. Our colleagues all volunteers. And our clients are, of course, researchers, students, journalists, and other individuals. But it's not just a collection. We are working a lot of any other activities, like exploring cultural heritage in Hungary, and we are publishing essays and held lectures in special places. We were take on in this this academic program, which was leading by Judith Takács, who is a very famous sociologist professor in Hungary. She is exploring the homosexuality. We took part in an international project, Courage, which was aimed to explore the cultural resistance in the socialist time, socialist period. And this was coordinated by the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. There was an exhibition where the first Hungarian LGBT association was shown. I took this. I had a lecture in this Courage conference also. We are co-organizer of the LGBT History Month, which was Peter was will talk about. We are had a commemoration at Karl Maria Kerbeni's tomb in Budapest Cemetery. Every year we took part in an LGBT reading marathon, which was a very special event when a famous Hungarian actors and actresses was reading continuously for hours from experts from LGBT novel, and we were one of the editors of this program. We had partnerships with public libraries, like the biggest Budapest library, Szabó Ervin, and there is a special the Semmelweis University, and we had international relations. There was a in 2008 we were in a study trip in Amsterdam. We took part in Open Up project. Joseph Hawkins, the professor, visited us in Budapest and see our archives. He's the one archive director. Orla Egan held a study for us about her digitization program in Budapest a few years ago. Also, we are working on a network program with Fundacja, which is a new Polish LGBT organization, and we took part in conferences in Amsterdam, in London, and I was invited to an IFLA conference in Wrocław, which is an international librarians conference. And some words about the future. We are organizing an oral history program, and we would like to make a web page, a special web page about the cultural historical heritage, maybe a LGBT community center, and we are thinking about the digitization of the materials. And Peter, the next.
Okay. A moment. In Hungary, LGBT History Month has been organized since 2013 after the British model each year in February. The series of programs is coordinated by Háttért Society and Labris Lesbian Association in cooperation with many other LGBT and non-LGBT organizations, groups, scholarly and cultural institutions and individuals. In 2019, we organized it for the seventh time. We joined the international program series in 2012. Two volunteers of Háttér and Labris participated in the Scottish-led one-week training, Engaging Hearts and Minds, in Ljubljana with Lithuanian, Dutch, Czech and Irish activists. Here we got to know the Scottish experiences and we got ideas for organizing our own LGBT History Month. We are proud to have established a tradition in Hungary during these 7 years. Let's look at some summarizing numbers. During the 7 years, a total of 283 events have been organized, and the programs have reached about 11,000 people.
Over the past 7 years, we have been working with nearly 40 partners to recollect LGBT people's history in the most diverse forms. As I mentioned, the two main organizers are HATTÉR and Labris Association. The organizing team of approximately 10 people chooses the main theme of the year. We organize the opening and closing event and the sponsors party. We provide the costs of this, coordinate the communication of the program series, and compile the program booklet. We keep in touch with the organizers of individual programs, advise locations, and support the implementation of the bottom-up programs. We usually start the organization in September of the previous year, and then write the program application in October, November. In December, we coordinate programs with partner organizations, organize a fundraising campaign, and finalize the program in January and publish the program booklet. In February, the programs are implemented with the involvement of volunteers, and the whole program series is evaluated in March. In recent years, we have involved cooperating partners such as major Hungarian LGBT organizations, Atlas Sport Association, Budapest Pride, Hungarian LGBT Alliance, Mosaic Christian Community, Symposium Association, Transvanilla Transgender Association, etc., as well as Amnesty International, Civil AIDS Forum, Ötvös Loránd University, Israeli Cultural Institute, Central European University, the LGBTQ section of the Hungarian Psychological Society, the Institute of Sociology of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, and the Association of History Teachers. Looking back to the opening personalities of the History Month so far, in 2013, Károly Mack, the director of the first Hungarian openly lesbian themed film, Another Way, opened a series of programs. Subsequently, international experts such as the German gay Holocaust researcher Günter Grau, the American historian and transgender history researcher Susan Stryker, and the gender expert Hedlizé Rankin opened the program series. The Hungarian opening persons included the philosopher and former politician János Kiss, one of the actors of the Szivárvány case, and Judit Takács, a sociologist, historian, researcher of Károly Kertbeni. Two prominent Hungarian drag queens, Lady Dömper and Miss Mandarin, were the opening people of this year in the spirit of Stonewall. In 2014, the English historian Jeffrey Weeks gave a lecture. In recent years, there have been lectures on topics such as the Amor Lesbicus in the light of pre-war Hungarian medical literature, the life and work of Oscar Wilde, Edvard Prime Stevenson and her novel Imre, Gays and Lesbians in the Weimar Republic, the history of the American homophile movement, homosexuality in the Hungarian court cases of the 50s, or the history of modern queer operas. Roundtable discussions were organized on the following topics: gay life before the regime change, Lajos Romzauer and the first Hungarian LGBT organization Homeros, the history of the first Hungarian LGBT newspaper Mások, the beginnings of the history of Budapest Pride, contradictory personalities in the Hungarian LGBT history, or the opportunities of the education of LGBT history. We considered it important to evoke the history of LGBT people through various art branches. Gábor Czajzer, director, presented the relationship of Verlaine and Rambo in the framework of reading theater. The exhibition Confronting the Rules presented the lives of LGBT athletes in 2018, we presented Károly Kertbeni's life and LGBT human rights work in the form of traveling exhibition. And the Hungarian graphic artist Dorode Bianco Zoltán Fehér drew portraits of well-known Hungarian LGBT people. We also screen several films every day, documentaries such but before Stonewall, after Stonewall, and Maria Takács's two documentaries, Secret Years and Hot Pan Cold Dictatorships, and feature films. In addition, there are other interactive programs such as LGBT historical quiz games happening in honor of Hilda Gobbi, Pink Budapest Walks, Wikipedia editing marathons, and same-sex ball dancing. Our financial resources are limited to organize to the LGBT History Month. We do not receive any state support because of the homophobic Orban government. We can rely primarily on foreign donors as the foundation, the Dutch and American embassies, and our fundraising campaign. The organization is complicated by the homophobic environment, the homophobic statements of the leading public figures, and the government actions directed NGO, against NGOs. It is also becoming more frequent that neo-Nazi groups disrupt LGBT events. We hope that the LGBT History Month will be held in Hungary many more times in the future. Next year we are planning to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the first Pride March in New York, the 25th anniversary of Hattie Society, and the 125th anniversary of Oscar Wilde's trials. One of our long-term plans is to achieve that the history of LGBT people appear in school, but this is still a serious problem in Hungary. Thank you for your attention.
Lecture, and I think we have a lot of questions about how you have done it, because you've been doing this for a long time. The last speakers are Anina Alaska and Giosefina Letieri, and Anina is working at the Hygiene Museum in Dresden, and you're working with the Schwule Museum in Berlin, but you're talking, you're being linked to that anyway, but you're going to talk about that.
Thank you, Rita. I'm part of the coordinating team of the Queer History Month with my two team members who are here as well today. And I'm also working at the Archive of Youth Cultures, and I'm part of an educational queer project there. But I'm mostly going to talk about the Queer History Month in Berlin today. And the Queer History Month in Berlin takes place every year in May, and is kind of a loose network and initiative of archives, museums, libraries, and educational organizations for LGBTIQ plus history. And these are mainly the cooperating organizations since like 3 years who are really taking a part of the monthly meetings we are having from like this year. We started in January till late February to organize and discuss what we want to do during the Queer History Month 2019. And we have educational projects, but also are closely linked to archives like the Lesbian Archive, Spinboden, and the Feminist Archive in Berlin, but also the Schwules Museum or the Youth Museum, and also BPOC organizations like GLAAD in Berlin. The Queer History Month started in 2012, mostly as a web portal to provide educational material for teachers and educational workers. And it also has like content on the website, video interviews with queer activists, and also audio guided tours. This was kind of a cooperation project with the exhibition 2 years ago from the Schwules Museum and German Historian Museum, Deutsches Historisches Museum, called Homosexualities, a very, very famous, successful exhibition in Berlin, where you can find like a map with queer subcultural places that are still in Berlin, but you can still find in Berlin, or also vanished or disappeared. I also want to talk about funding and how we can manage to do the Queer History Month in Berlin. Luckily, we get funding from the Senate of Berlin, and we have like an initiative that is aiming to support self-empowerment and acceptance of gender and sexual diversity in Berlin. And so we have it's a top-down implementation. It's not bottom-up, grassroots, and so it's not very like a voluntarily commitment, more like kind of mandatory that the schools are encouraged to address queer history and queer topics in their school curriculum, and each school in Berlin has to name a contact person for queer topics, and you can also apply for a new label called Schule der Vielfalt, School of Diversity, if you agree to do regular workshops with the students, but also with the teachers, how to address gender and sexual diversity more substantially within schools. But on the other hand, there's always a fundamental lack of resources. We don't have much budget to realize the Queer History Month, to be honest. And also the teachers always tell me that they do it on top. And it's kind of, often the contact person is the queer teacher, the openly gay, lesbian, trans teacher at the school. And so it's like the obligation duty to do it, kind of. Thing. That's also a problem. I joined the Queer History Month with my queer project in 2016, and I realized that it's very white, predominantly white and cisgendered, and there's a lack of diversity and marginalized perspective within the network. So we started a new approach this year, asking more questions and not giving many answers, focusing more on intersectionality and anti-racial perspectives. And I'm part of the new coordinating team, and I speak from a queer feminist, cis female of color, working class background, and I'm still a minority in this network. And so I reached out to BPOC organizations to join the networks, and luckily they said yes and participated this year. And I want to tell you a bit about a project that kind of empowered me to address these issues within this predominantly white network, and that was the street art and video project we did in 2017, where the students asked us to combine black and queer history in the project. So we did like stances of 8 gender and black revolutionaries. They prepared a statement that we recorded, and then we went to places that are kind of linked to these persons or where their legacy lives on, and we talked to experts like Joshua Akins Quasi from the Initiative of Black People in Germany. But we also went to the Magnus Hirschfeld Gesellschaft to talk to Ralf Dose about the legacy and life of Magnus Hirschfeld. And we also asked passengers if they knew the people that we were portraying. And surprisingly, everybody knew David Bowie, but nobody knew Audre Lorde, for example. and it's kind of interesting if you leave your career in this bubble. And ask people randomly on the street if they know the people that you are portraying. And this was kind of a turning point for me and also for the network to be focused more on intersectionality and really have that it was part of what the students wanted to do as well. And this year we managed to realize about 20 events in Berlin. And these are mostly all of the organizations that took part in it. And we also work with a network that wants to queer exhibitions. We work with universities and theaters. And we also were lucky to have a reading here at the HKW in May, where trans of color activist and artist Sunny Est read and commented on texts from Magnus Hirschfeld, we invited a black a queer activist, a spoken word artist, and she did a lecture at a black space in Berlin Wedding, EOTO, Each One Teach One, very important place in Berlin. We did a film screening at the Schulz Museum, focusing more on her resilience and subcultural queer activism. We did the workshop where we addressed questions how to queer exhibitions and not queer spaces. We did a voguing empowering workshop as well, and a theater play that addressed more like heteronormativity in our society. And I do have flyers if you're interested in what we did this year. Unfortunately, it's in German. Apologies for that. But if you're interested, you can take them. And I think I
can
over.
Give them a round.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now I give you the chance.
Hi, my name is Anina, and before starting to work at the Hygiene Museum in Dresden, I worked at the Schulz Museum in Berlin, and I also was part of the Queer History Month group this year, and I want to talk about difficulties, but also about challenges and potentials of the Queer History Month. Because also the Schulz Museum, the Gay Museum, which was found in 1985 in Berlin, so it's a really old institution, one of the first gay museums in the world. It's also like a really white museum. It's also like mainly speaking from a cis perspective. And with this year's 3 months, we wanted to like change the perspectives and add more perspectives. And that's why I want to talk like briefly about how to take an intersectional perspective if your museum, your objects, your exhibitions do not. And I have one example here. This is part of the exhibition, which was at the Schulz Museum, I think, until now. They're now setting up a new exhibition. And this was part of this change of scenery exhibition. You see a world map, and you see the countries that still persecute homosexuality. And I think this map is like really important and really interesting, and it's good to know. But there are also difficulties about this map, because the museum is mainly like speaking from a white and like really they are kind of celebrating that like we now have the right to marry and stuff like this, but they don't tell anything about, for example, Pakistani history, about history you can see here, but from Saudi Arabia or from Somalia, and they only tell like the emancipation history and the victories like the generations who were before us made. And we got, of course, lots of critics for this wall, and I was also like one of the members in the museum. There were many more who criticized this map. We tried to change this, we tried to do something with it, and also try to tell positive stories of Pakistan, for example. Here also some I heard a talk from two persons from Pakistan, and it's amazing what they do there. And here it's only written that that you get to prison if you're homosexual. So it's only one part of the story. And so what I want to point out is that we got these critics from Pakistani friends who came to the museum and presented the RKS video film festival. And I wanted to, because I'm telling you this because I wanted to cooperate with a institution here in Berlin, a queer migrant organization, and we already had a plan what we could do for the Queer History Month, and like it was a really good plan, I think. But in the end, we had lots of discussion how we can work in the museum. And in the end, we kind of failed, because it wasn't really possible to do a project there with this wall in the museum. And at the beginning, I was kind of sad that it couldn't happen, but I think we all learned a lot from that. And the Queer History Month is such a good place to try to cooperate, and maybe even if you fail in the beginning, I think next year it will happen, or maybe in 2 years it will happen, but it's a start, and you have to try. And that's why I'm talking about this example. And so I think the big question is, how can we as educators work with this exhibition? How can we still do good projects with the students? And what I did in the end was I added objects to the exhibition. I added Audre Lorde, I added Silvia Rivera. I gave the students material from the, like, the stories which aren't told in the exhibition. And yeah, what you can see here, we add objects, we can create our own narratives, we can do an intervention in the exhibition, which we also did in the end. And we can also empower pupils to write their own story. We can, like, we can do so much. We can go, like, to the Queer History Month network. We can empower ourselves, and yeah, that's what I wanted to give you as an example, and from the Schulz Museum in Berlin.
Thank you. Thank you. I think this is a good ending for this session and a good start for the questioning. Maybe we could take like 2 minutes when you in the audience, you can just ask the person next to you and what they do and how they work. And then I ask the people who have spoken to come up so we can see it. So it's probably easier than if you're in the audience and the sound was racing. And but let's just continue with the discussion. Anybody who wants to ask something, pull up and please say your name and where you come from.
Let's go this side.
Okay, my name is Tuula Juvonen. I come from the University of Tampere, and I have a question for Tom about Speak Out History Lab.
Yes.
What is it?
What is it? So it is. It's first of all, I suppose, like a stakeholder group. So we have our various sort of academic and kind of community sort of stakeholders who advises on programming, on content, those sorts of things. But the idea is that it kind of feeds into our events program. So to give that quite concrete example, we run monthly events. So we have a Wednesday evening, first Wednesday of the month, we run what we call LGBTQ plus History Club, and then we also have workshops, a series of workshops throughout the year. So what the sort of lab does, it kind of lets us expand our network. So for example, on some of the workshops we run workshops on Saturday morning, the idea is that it's going to be, and it's still kind of in its early stages, but it will give us sort of contacts, but also kind of a platform to invite people to come and do things, but things that are kind of unfinished, they can be tentative. We're not asking, for example, if academics could come, they don't have to give their finished paper. They can say, oh, I'm working on these ideas, and like a bit of an audience, a kind of a work in progress. So the jargon sometimes talk about sandpits, but this idea of a place where you can kind of bring the ideas that you've got, or I've got this idea for an event or a performance, can I give it a go in that kind of low risk, sort of low thing, right? You're not promising it's finished, you're kind of a thinking out loud kind of a space, an experimental space, hence the term lab.
I wanted to address something you brought up.
Say who you are.
Amy Levine, happily retired. something you addressed that concerns me a great deal, and I'd like some of you to think about it, talk about it. The question of whether in many institutions this really important work focuses or centers on one really dedicated person. And how are, to come to your question, how are we going to sustain it? Because I hope some of you will enjoy my happiness eventually, and that your work will not die with, you know, when you leave the institutions. So if some of you care to comment on that.
That's exactly the thing. Yeah, well, that's what we were discussing. And what we are thinking about is, I would love to work in a museum. And I have the skills as a curator. I have the skills built for over more than a year, but the institution doesn't want to hire me at this moment because they think I'm probably only focusing on the sole issue, but that's not the case. I'm only an activist for that part, but I'm also a professional, and that's very difficult because if people see you as that one person, that queer person that focuses on activism and on queer issues, then they are afraid that they can only use you for that, but that's not true.
Okay.
I'm just as much a curator as our colleagues are in the museum. I think, and maybe Miriam.
Yeah, we were discussing that as well, and I don't know how it is for the other parts, but I do think at this moment within the Amsterdam Museum, it's because we've got a group of very people working voluntarily or for a lower money, like not the same amount as the people working in the museum. And personal, I think it's my my goal as well to get the museum to keep it going, which does take quite a lot of free time as well to get it in a proper way up and running. It's not really into the policy yet, and that's the problem. Mm-hmm. So it's very still based on issue dates or very based on personal enthusiastic, and you have to put in a lot of time to make it happen in such a good way and such a good quality. So I think it needs a policy change. It does happen in Amsterdam now because of our government of the city of Amsterdam. They are really, you know, we can't do, we have to change as an institution. Though as well, we do have five curators. From the five curators, we have got only one person of color as a curator, only since 2 years, and we're living in 2019. So that's quite a thing. And I think, but that's not as how happy I can make it, we do have some colleagues who are really by person involved within the LGBT communities as well, but they don't really want to take on the subject straight away because they don't want to do it themselves, because then it probably is like a personal thing instead of something you...
That you see more often. Yeah. The City Archive in Amsterdam had exactly the same. The colleague said, when it was a straight woman, who said, we're going to queer the archive. Oh yeah, but I'm gay in my personal life, not in my professional life, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
Those are the wolves.
Yeah, no. Well, I don't judge them. I will never judge them because it's their choice. But I do think it's the responsibility of the institute to have someone hired that can work on those topics and is willing to.
Yeah.
It's very difficult because you cannot say to someone, "Yeah, you're gay, so you have to do the subject." Mm-hmm. That's positive discrimination. You cannot do that.
Yeah. And it's also, of course, it's a knowledge. It's not like anybody can just queer a collection. It's a knowledge that you have to have.
I don't quite know how it happened, but I would say that where I work on the Metropolitan Archives, it has happened, but it's not. We have had a very dedicated member of staff that sort of driven it and seeded it, but now it is part of what we do. So I do this because it's something I've come to through my working life. I had no particular interest in this topic before starting work. It's something I now do as part of my, I think, so that I'm gay in my professional life but not my personal life, to take that the other way, take that the other way around. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's part of the expectation that we do. It's part of what we do. So our remit is to serve the history of London and Londoners, to be LGBTQ, as be part of London history. So it comes from part of that. And it also, so the workshop things that I've talked about, we have an annual conference, that's part of our programme of work. If we suddenly stopped doing that because someone left, that would actually make us look quite bad. That would be, I think, real reputational damage to what we do if we were to do that. So at some point, and I can't quite tell you how, but I think if you do it long enough, it becomes part of what you do, becomes part of your programming just because. And I would say there's also a sense where, in my presentation, I talked about those challenges, but I do mean that challenge in a very positive sense of how it's changed our archival practice. So there's a lot of value just to become from, as you do something, it becomes part of what you do, and then that affects all the things that you do. So I've taken this approach of evidencing other sides of the past, of realising the limitations of kind of the institutions that we keep and how they kind of don't tell the stories of the more personal ones, into other areas, so for example, disability history. And it kind of grows from that. So I think there's also that realisation that these different kind of analytical, different effective tools, different creative ways for working just enrich everything that you do. And that's something that can be appreciated and really sung and celebrated as well.
My name is Rima Knolf. I'm from Amsterdam. I'm part of the group of Jansa Museum. Didn't Anina and Giuseppina give a kind of direction, a kind of opening a door towards which way to travel? You broadened to my experience, you broadened the issue from LGBT to intersectionality, which means you're not only or not anymore an identity policy maker or activist, but you're actually into inclusiveness as a major concept, embracing LGBT causes, but also opening up to wider empowerment, new generations, and multiple identity choices. Our experience is that addressing the boards of institutions, not on an LGBT agenda, but on an inclusiveness agenda, you have, as a board of directors, to take position towards major issues of inclusiveness, opens up the way to keep it on the table, to make it part of your major long-term policy plans. So I think, or my suggestion would be, and I would like to hear what your opinion is, in playing the card, not of the LGBT issue, but of the LGBT issues as part of a larger policy or a larger development view. That would make, that would be a condition to make it, to give it, to give the durability, the sustainability that at this point in time we are seeing that is lacking at many points, at many places.
I think that especially in the Netherlands, that the problem I think is well, not as much problem, but there's a huge racism debate in the Netherlands, and that's also diversity means actually is based on color and ethnicity, and not so much on diversity broader, as in we mean inclusivity, and this is also why I constantly like to stress, let's focus on inclusivity and not on diversity, because it has a different connotation. And what we actually want to do is to embrace our, well, our people, everyone. That's not what our institutions have done.
There was a question.
Yeah, I just want to agree with you. I'm Toby. I work in a public library in Melbourne, and I also volunteer for ALGA, who probably already know at this point. But I would agree with you that, like, I think our organisation at the library has also reached that point where it's kind of become a cultural thing. Possibly through hiring practices, because like there's a lot of trans and queer staff just as casuals on the front desk interacting with the public, but also I think possibly because of the geographic situation, like we have a community that is voting for the council that funds the library, so it's possibly a community pressure, and because the library exists to serve its community, I guess maybe there's a feedback loop that helps reinforce that.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Sorry. I was just saying, I was agreeing that I work in an organisation that seems to have reached that point as well. And I think part of that is because it is a community organisation and there is a public electing the board of it, essentially. And that public is quite queer. It's in a Melbourne seat that is quite progressive. I think that's possibly helped with that. I was also surprised that you had so little ephemera, because at ALGA we're drowning it.
Yes, we have a lot more now. It's again just the I suppose idiosyncrasies, the quirks of the question. So we have a lot now, but it's just not something that really necessarily fitted with how we collect. So we have some, I think it's something we've moved towards, but it's I think maybe being a local authority archive, it worked on a slightly bigger scale. I mean, it's not unique to the LGBT collection that we started collecting ephemera. We started collecting ephemera for, say, the 2012 Olympic Games, those sorts of things. But I think it just took a particular project just to get it going. And it's hard for us to say, if someone comes along and says, I've got a couple of things, it doesn't really work. I mean, we have ephemera in collections that people have donated. We have a particular collection, a man called Gerald Kremenstein. There's plenty in his collection, but it's the Gerald Kremenstein collection.
Yeah,
it's not
small.
It's sort of one box of things. But if you were to sort of we've not really been in the habit, or might have not been in the habit of, you know, say after a pride or after a march, bring us your banners. You know, there's other institutions among the bishops gate famous for that. But, you know, after a big march, quick picking up the placard. It's just not what we've not what we've done. I don't think it's more or less than that, really.
Yeah.
There and there and there.
Hello, I'm Sabir. I'm from Israel, and I'm just trying to establish an archive of social struggles in Israel, including a career archive. And since, and I'm asking the Budapest archive about it, since we don't want to get, we can't get funded from the government, but also we don't want to because we're afraid. We're not afraid. We know that the work that we're going to do is going to be used for Israeli propaganda and pinkwash. How do you manage to outreach the public with events and activities that you do to gain a support and also financial support from the public and the community to establish the archive and also the continuance of the archive for the long run?
The archive is part of the society, but one program of society, and the society is make and applies for grants and for money.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hungarian government is not a gay-friendly and LGBT-friendly government, as you know. And the people in Hungary has no so many money to give donations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we are the society try to organize such programs, which are complex programs, which are HIV protection and legal aid programs, and the archive has a little place to collect some articles, for example, and the main donators are from the European Union and the Norwegian Fund, I think, but the government has no, just very 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 little funds. From Hungary, from Hungary, not the Hungarian government, but Hungarian fund, Hungarian national fund or something like this. And the basic of the work is voluntary work. And the society is working with almost 100 volunteers. This all of the programs. The society has lots of programs. The archive has three. Stable volunteers and some other people who are who have some free time to work. Somebody is working one occasion a year, or this is the this, so these are the resources.
Hi, I'm Terry Beswick with the GLBT, the Historical Society in San Francisco, and we're a community-based archives, an independent archives. We also do have a municipal archives in San Francisco, and we've had a bit of a rivalry going for a couple of decades now, sometimes over funding, but really just around public awareness. And I think in the beginning, it was necessary for us to have a community-based versus a municipal archives for reasons of censorship and ownership of the materials over time. Now, I think it's different more for research purposes, just to have a place that people can go that is just very queer-specific. But the question I really wanted to ask was about the Queer History Month, and I really enjoyed the presentation on that. And we, actually in the U.S., we celebrate Queer History Month in October.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why we have a different month, but it would be nice if we had the same. But I'm interested in particular how you collaborate with different organizations, and I'm wondering if there's if that is helpful to the archives, and the Schwulz archives in particular, in terms of diversifying
mm-hmm.
the collections,
mm-hmm.
To really engage with different organizations that are maybe not even queer specific.
Mm-hmm. I talked to the feminist archive and the lesbian archive, and they also stress that they don't get material from migrant perspectives or BPOC communities, and that is what they are aiming for in the future. And so it was important for them that we can do projects together so that BPOC organizations realize, okay, they are focusing more on giving us or making space for us and acknowledging that queer is also black and of color, has perspectives that we haven't included in the past year. So it's, these are tiny steps right now to build trust, to build alliances on, and to be more inclusive, but not in a buzzword kind of way or tokenism, more on really acknowledging what they did in the past as activists. And so I think we can all benefit from what we are trying to do now, and we have to see what the future holds, because we have, like, I think, three BPOC organizations that said that they want to participate in the next year as well. And so these are tiny steps built on trust. And a lot of we're doing the Queer History Month in May because there was kind of a clash, because we also did it the past years in February, like London, but in Berlin, we had the Black History Month in London, in Berlin in February, and so this was always kind of, okay, and they did not really cooperate, and this was like a competition thing, and then last year we talked with a lot of organizers of the Black History Month, and they said, okay, can you move to another month, please? And so we did that, and we decided to do the month in May, this was kind of a step from us to build trust and to form new alliances. And so, I think there's a long way to go still, and a lot of also failure, but failure is often also a good part of talking to each other and getting to know each other and embracing the differences we have in our identities, and also the different struggles we are facing in this still very racist society in Germany as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would like to add that what you're saying is correct, that the Queer History Month, for example, or other networks like the Arns Conference, or in Berlin we also have the Museen Queer in Berlin Netzwerk, which is like museum queering network, and we meet like four times a year. And Queer History Month, we also like meet before the actual Queer History Month, like every month. Mm. And it's like a good reason to meet. You know, you can tell your institution, yeah, we're organizing this educational program, and it's a reason to sit down together and talk about projects together. And I think there are many new projects, not only Queer History Month, happen afterwards. Mm. So new cooperations between institutions in Berlin. I think it's like a really good network now.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I have to. There are two questions, and then that will be in. There was actually something that I was thinking about, that how what happens in the institutions when they take part.
Yeah.
And I think that we can continue. Tomorrow there will be several sessions also linked to this. But maybe we take the questions after each other, and then you can reply. So.
My name is Sarah. I'm from Leiden University. This is sort of a half-thought-through question, but it's sort of reflecting on some of the other kind of panels that I've been at in the last few months. I've been working with this particular archive of photographs by a Dutch photographer, a queer Dutch photographer who was in Palestine in the early 1920s, and, you know, picking up on some of these themes of intersectionality. And I don't really come from a background where I've studied sexuality. I'm much more, my research is much more focused on Palestine. But one of the things, looking at these sort of photographs, you know, it starts to become apparent that there are very different modes of sexuality outside of the non-Western world, and in this case, in it's sort of Levantine Arab world. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, in terms of thinking in these intersectional ways and thinking about, you know, modes of decolonizing academic thought, etc., you know, I'm starting to wonder how useful terms like homosexual, queer, lesbian, gay, etc., are in describing non-Western sexualities. And I was particularly wondering, you know, if you have some comments around that or some thoughts around how you might think that through in a public programming sort of setting, or sort of start to open up a discussion.
you can think about that. Expected
to be
a better question. Thank you.
Here I would just like to take the opportunity to mention that tomorrow is the CAFE Global the CAFE Global meeting at 1 p.m. I will have a presentation about the archives of Lambda Warszawa, because so my case is quite similar to the case of our Hungarian friends, that we also have a location and growing archive. Our collections are already quite impressive, I think, considering the circumstances. And this organization, Lambda Warszawa, the oldest Polish LGBT organization, has become a kind of a cultural, educational center, and also activist center, help center. So if anyone is interested in archives in Eastern Europe, well, it would be nice to meet you tomorrow. And I'm also interested in one thing. How do you feel in your organization in Budapest? Do you feel comfortable? Because, for example, our countries, Poland and Hungary, are now a bit in the same boat, because they both have right-wing governments, which are anti-LGBT and so on. But we in Poland are in a kind of a bit lucky situation, because actually the authorities of Warsaw are kind of liberal / left-wing. And even paradoxically, although we have Mr. Kaczyński, who is well-known as a right-wing politician, the vice president of Warsaw is openly gay. He's a bit like Klaus Wowereit, yeah? So this is kind of a paradox. So we have a location at the preferential rental fees and so on. So in this, in one sense, we feel comfortable, but in the sense of the political climate in the country, it's different. But on the other hand, we organize parades, Pride, Warsaw Pride, for example. The last one took place a few weeks ago, and there were about 12,000 or 15,000 participants. So that's quite, I think, impressive by Eastern European standards. So anyway, I would like to invite you to tomorrow at 1 p.m. Café Global.
Thank you for the question. Do you want to say something about the question that was directed to about?
I said something very general.
I think language is a
tricky one, and I can claim no expertise around sort of Western and non-Western use of language, but have thought about language across time. I think from a public perspective, I think it just plays just quite pragmatic about language and think what it's for. So in terms of catalogue, so as an engagement officer in an archive, I think about language as directing people to the records that they want to see. I think language as directing people to the events that they want to go to. And it's really for cleverer people than I to work out the conceptual mapping between homosexuality and language and how that changes over time. So I'm happy if it's close enough, if it's not giving offence, and it's directing people and getting people to the rooms and the records they want to see, and then letting people make up their own mind.
And maybe there are researchers as well from it was from Palestine that have written about sexuality and gender and the way they use terms and define. We just have to finish it. We are already 3 minutes over time. We have three rules about this.
Are there something? And Kate gave me an announcement.
Okay.
It's about the walking tours.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. So the walking tours. From 14, there is one the Finns queer tour meetup at the info desk at 14:45. Okay, and that is full, so
somebody might be already in it.
Thank you.
Right, thank you.